Welcome to Haldane's Law Matters. Thank you. Our guest today is an unusual character. His name is Jay Chan, and he's unusual for a guest on our podcast, Jay, if you'll forgive me for saying so, because you're not a lawyer or a doctor or an accountant. But you are, I think, the quintessential person who came to Hong Kong and made good. And I think there's an interest in people like yourself who don't fit into any easy category, but have had colourful and successful lives in Hong Kong. And without going to the end chapter first, I know you to be a great supporter of Hong Kong and the region. So welcome to Haldane's Law Matters. So Jay, you don't fit into any easy category, and for that reason alone, you're an unusual guest to this podcast. But we welcome you, and I'm going to be interested in finding out how it is that you've made a life and a success of a life in Hong Kong.
Okay. Number one, like a lot of us, we come to Hong Kong for initially 3 months to give it a try. And then before you know it, 42 years go by. But of those 42 years, I have to say, 20 plus, I have been a client of Haldane. So a couple of things. One, never lie to your doctor, and two, never lie to your lawyer.
I'm glad to hear you say that. In fact, when I invited you to be a guest on this podcast, I hadn't appreciated that you'd been a client at all.
Yeah, so with another partner of yours.
Yes, mine's the criminal defense division. I'm happy to exclude you from that. I think you were more in the corporate side.
Corporate side, absolutely.
All right. Well, listen, as a client of Haldane's and as a long-term Hong Kong belonger, welcome to this podcast. So can you just go back in time and give the listeners a little bit of an idea of your early days, the days perhaps before you were in Hong Kong? Because I know that you have a sort of travelogue before you arrived in Hong Kong and made it your home.
First of all, I was born in Beijing, 1959, when China was going through its difficult periods. And my father was actually a British subject. And we went through the Cultural Revolution. I was actually with my parents in the countryside. And the reason we were there was because my father was a revolutionary, and he insisted on writing these big wall posters, while at the same time, he tore up his British papers. And lo and behold, we were in the countryside.
I see. Were you forced into the countryside?
No, No, to be fair, we were directed there by Zhou Enlai, because had we stayed on in the cities, we probably would have died.
Of what?
Killing. What?
I mean, not starvation or something.
No, when I was small, I saw people cemented into the corners of the bathrooms and stuff. I mean, all kinds of stuff going on. We were sent to the countryside, and every single time the Red Guards, the 516, which answered to Jiangqing, came down to try to get us. The peasants would stand around our house with giant sticks and say, come on, try.
So how was your father part of the British?
He was a British Communist Party member at one point. And in 1938, he started going to China. And he actually went to Yan'an. He met Mao and Zhou Enlai and Zhu De, the marshal. And he wanted to stay on. And then they convinced him to go back to London and start the Xinhua News Agency London branch.
I see.
And then do propaganda work and stuff. And then after the war, he was invited back to China to be the English editor of Peking Review.
After the Second World War, is that?
No, after the Civil War.
Ah.
Yeah.
Talk about that.
Well, my father, my uncle actually was at one point a barrister in Hong Kong, Percy Chen. They were answerable to my grandfather, and they were on the left side of the KMT, and they were sympathizers or whatever. Hmm. When the Civil War ended, Percy, my uncle, he represented all of China's business interests out of Hong Kong, 140-some companies. My father was the English editor of Peking Review, a propaganda kind of a piece. And my mother, at one point, was the translator of movies that Jiangqing used to watch. Mao's wife liked to watch English language movies. So I was born into an environment that was somewhat privileged. But during the Cultural Revolution, you know, my father insisted on writing these big wall posters. He didn't speak Chinese, and so he couldn't get the effects that he was looking for, so he had them translated. But at the same time, he tore up his British papers. So when people were reading these, they looked at it and they say, hey, he's one of us. And at that time, it wasn't good to be one of anybody.
It was dangerous wherever you stood. Yeah. So what, and your mother's background?
My mother, she attended St. Mary's Hall in Shanghai, as a typical Shanghai miss, and spoke excellent English, et cetera, et cetera. And then later, after we came out of the country, China, he worked in academia, but then eventually went on to publish 3 books. The last one was The Secret Listener, published by Oxford University Press, 2021.
So, and what age would you have been while this was all happening?
I was in the countryside when I was age 10. I came out to Hong Kong age 11, and then we went on to the U.S. after about 8 months. So after that, I grew up in the U.S.
So just before we go to the U.S., a vivid memory, by the sound of it, of all
one
this
word,
stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah?
One word.
Because it was a very colorful and intense time.
Yeah, yeah.
Was it disturbing?
It was, because the one episode I remember very well is you attend these struggle meetings where people wear these dunes hat down
yes,
with.
Yes.
And there I was with my little friends watching this, and then somebody turned around and said, what are you doing here? Your father is next.
My goodness, yeah.
And guess what? My father was next. You remember that.
So you would remember that. I get that. So who went to America? Yourself and?
My father, my mother, and myself. Yeah.
So you were effectively fleeing China?
No, actually no, because the British did not want my father back. So all this, you know, liberal whatever, it didn't hit anybody yet, right? The British didn't want us in Hong Kong even.
Because he was supporting the communists?
He was at one point a British Communist Party member. Right?
And they didn't like that?
They didn't like that.
Okay.
Yeah? So they wanted him to go to Trinidad, where my father was born, had gone independent. And it was the only Caribbean Commonwealth that if you were born there, you take up the citizenship there as opposed to get British papers.
I see.
So we were getting our Trinidad papers. At the same time, the way we came to Hong Kong was Zhou Enlai had signed a piece of paper with my photo and my mom and my dad's photo that got us in here, right? So when I was crossing the Shenzhen Bridge, it was literally just the grass hatch bridge.
To be clear about this then, you had support from up high, in China.
Yeah, because that time they were already, the Americans, the CIA station, etc. Everybody was already primed for the Kissinger, the reapproachment.
So this is right out of a John le Carrier book, isn't it, really?
Yeah, we ended up in New York. The people who sponsored us was Governor Rockefeller, New York State.
Now, pause.
Yeah.
So the Brits didn't want you because of the communism. The Chinese wanted to keep you safe and got your family out.
The Americans wanted us.
But how did that fit in with McCarthyism?
But that's long after. This is 1971.
They were welcoming communists?
No, they weren't, because we were sponsored to get into the U.S. by Governor Rockefeller.
A well-known communist.
Yeah. But the James Buckleys of this world, the senators and whatnot, because the Taiwan forces were still strong in the U.S.,
okay.
Right? They were still in the U.N. They were after us. So we get bricks sent to our home and all that.
You got bricks sent to your home?
Yeah.
Through the window?
No, at the door, wrapped.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, talk about bricks in a completely different context a little later.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I've been to a couple of countries, and then I've got 2 Jewish brothers, right? One in Moscow, whom I visited last in 2019, and then one in Beijing, but his mother was English Jewish. So we are a multinational family.
You're not Jewish?
No, I'm not Jewish.
Just it's your half-brothers that are Jewish?
Their mothers were, yeah.
Okay. So really, yes, it's a stew.
We've been around.
All right, Jay. So that's the background, and that no doubt had a tremendous impact on shaping you.
Yes.
And you'd come through Hong Kong, but only briefly, on your way to New York.
Yeah. When I was 15 years old, the father of a friend of mine asked me, Jay, what do you want to do when you grow up? I was in high school in the U.S.
Yes. Did you ever grow up, Jay?
No. Good. I remained at age 16. And I said, I wanted to live in Hong Kong next to the ocean, and I wanted to work in China, and that would be 1975.
So was that based on your very short snapshot travel through Hong Kong on the way to New York? Is that where you got the idea?
Yes, the answer is because when my uncle went around town, when I went with him, Kowloon Town Club and all that, everybody bowed to him and things, and I thought to myself,
I could do with a bit of that.
I like that.
All right. Okay. So there you are in New York, and you're being asked what you want to do for your future. You mentioned that you wanted to go to Hong Kong, and that happened.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
Well, my parents were academics, and they had no clue how to guide me, advise me. So the only thing that was guiding me were my teachers. And one of them said, oh, Jay, you're good in math. Why don't you apply to engineering school, Cornell? And that's the only little bit of guidance I had. I didn't know what to do.
Did you go to Cornell?
I did go to Cornell. I did go to engineering. I did get my master's in engineering as well as MBA. And I still didn't know what to do.
Right.
And so I wanted to come here.
Okay, so the cookie crumbled in favor of Hong Kong.
No, not quite, because I had to look for a job. I found a job with an American industrial company, United Technologies. And in my letter, I said I wanted to go back to Asia. And they took me on that basis. They said, okay, stay here for 2 years. And then after 2 years, we will get you back in Asia. And that's what they did.
And that's what they did. Now, did you speak and read Chinese?
The term for umbrella, it took me 5 minutes. Because it was just disused. Yeah. So my father spoke no Chinese, so there was no reason for me to speak Chinese. So,
and you still don't?
I do.
A bit.
I can't write.
No. So there you were, this mixture with the early formative 10, 11, 12-year-olds in a very, very dangerous China.
Mm.
And you go through America, you get to Cornell, you get a degree, and you line yourself up with an American company that's going to bring you back to Hong Kong.
Yeah.
So you were already showing signs of being able to control your life.
Yes, I would say yes. Yes, certainly. I didn't know it at the time.
No.
But I was in control.
In fact, it's come as a shock to learn it now.
Yeah. So, There was a plan.
Well, it just seems that way to me. You were actually at a very early age taking control.
Well, I came here. They put me up at the old Hilton Hotel.
Yes.
And I traveled into China and I helped them set up the Tianjin Otis Elevator Joint Venture.
Oh, well, that was a big deal.
That was a big deal at the time. And I was a CFO there for 3.5 years. And I met my later partner, who knew one of your partners.
Yes.
And then, lo and behold, we decided to start our own consulting company.
And Haldane's played a role in assisting you.
Good. Certainly.
I'm pleased to hear it. Yeah. So tell me, part of the reason you're here today is because it seems to me that you're in a very good position to judge old China, and you've seen it over the years evolve.
Yeah.
And you're in a very good position to see how America works, because you were there in your early life and went to Cornell. And, of course, we probably agree, you and I, and we've discussed it before, that Hong Kong is at a crossroads, stuck between the West and the East as a result of its history. And I'm going to just suggest to you at the moment that we could introduce the idea that you're actually very positive about the future
of
Hong Kong. So should we just perhaps give some flavor to your thoughts on Hong Kong as it stands today?
Yeah, the book that comes to my mind is a book by Isaac Asimov, the science fiction writer.
Yes.
He wrote a book, The Gods Themselves. And the premise of the book is some scientist, he was at the intersection of the paraverse and the normal verse, and energy flowed.
Yes.
Hong Kong, to me, had always been at that intersection. It doesn't matter what happens in China and the U.S. and the world and all that. Hong Kong is always at that intersection. And it's that at intersection we get our energy, right? On the one side, Hong Kong, just like the Chinese across the border, it's savings, learning, studying, investing, etiquette, ethics, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
Okay, the old Confucius stuff.
Yes.
On the other side, it's technology, technology, technology. Well, now technology is evening up, but the behavior, the hardwiring on the two sides, they're still very, very different. But in Hong Kong, we're in the middle. And if we somehow can leverage that, we're going to be winning.
But the word somehow creeps in, because we'll accept, I think, that we're in a difficult... Yes. I mean, the world's in a difficult... Yeah. it's not a great patch we're in.
To do that somehow, for example, my daughter now is going to a U.S. name brand school, okay? And last summer, she was Zoom interning because it was her first year. She was Zoom interning for two movie production houses. But then during the conversation, and her job was to do script coverage, you read all the scripts coming in, and then you summarize into one page, and then you give it to your boss. Trash this, do that, right? Mm. But the thing is, it occurred to her, hey, but wait a minute. If she knew the people in the U.S. who do movies, and she gets to know the people in China and Hong Kong who do movies, which essentially is an investment business.
Yeah.
Scripts, money, directors, producers,
income.
Products, income, yeah. Right? Then for every script that comes in, if you do some, just an example, cultural adaptation, as long as you pay everybody their due, you got two movies.
Right.
For example.
Yes.
Right? And you're not going to be doing that in Shanghai, and you're not going to be doing that in New York.
In fact, not many people know this necessarily, but Hong Kong's actually quite a center for...
Used to be. It can come back.
What's stopping it at the moment?
I think all this national security and self-censorship and all that, which is, to me, I sort of say they think too much.
Who does?
The artists.
Okay. So the artists are put off by national security law.
They don't know what to make of it because they never went through Cultural Revolution. When people compare the leadership in Beijing to the leadership back then, my comment is you didn't know what was back then and you don't know what's going on now.
Right. So are we talking about local artists there particularly or overseas artists?
Local
artists being...
They're shy.
They're shy of the law because they don't know what they can say and what they can do.
That's right.
What's your view on this? Is it going to...
No, I think it's going to
even
change.
Out?
I think it's going to change because if you look at the, just for example, Baptist College, I think the last time I heard, which may be 2 years ago, 90% of their film study students are from the mainland.
Right.
They came here for something.
So is the way forward for Hong Kong that the
transfusion?
Yeah, transfusion. So the anxiety of the locals that are local Hong Kong people that are anxious, inclined to drift off and make their lives elsewhere.
Yeah.
And they're being replaced.
New people coming in.
Who are not as cowed by the situation as the... Do you worry about it?
No.
No.
No, absolutely not.
Doesn't affect you and you're happy with the way it's progressing.
Yeah. Because I sort of say I have, quote, let's just say suffered under... various governments, sort of say, tell me what the difference is.
It's no more or no less.
I don't like any of them.
Now, let's just that's taking a quick look at China and Hong Kong. Let's just, because it's very topical as we speak, let's just have a quick thought about the United States, which is the other country, of course, that was influential early on in your life. So what do you make of the United States at the moment? I mean, we're sitting on as we speak, only 24, 48 hours ago, heard that President Biden was stepping down. We've got Kamala Harris coming in, and we've still got Trump in the background making noise.
Let's just say that had we had this conversation 5 years ago, and somebody, one of us, were to say that two of the four top hotels in San Francisco has shut down, Newsom had to dress up San Francisco before Xi Jinping landed, the fentanyl issue, the migrants issue.
So we're talking about overseas dignitaries visiting and having to clean up San Francisco because of the
this
homeless.
This is what
the
Russians
drugs.
Used to do, I guess, right? Or the Chinese used to do.
My son came back from San Francisco recently. I haven't been for years. And I said, it's a lovely city, isn't it? He said, good God, Dad, it's full of homeless and street
No,
sleepers.
You come out of the San Francisco hotel, everything smells like piss, right?
I think, Jay, you've just crossed yourself off the possibility of a job in the tourist board for San Francisco.
But the thing is, had we been talking about this 5 years ago, people would have thought you're mad.
Yeah.
And yet here we are, right? And then on top of that, attempted assassination of a politician.
Yeah. So you're wearing your American hat just for a moment.
Yeah.
You're pessimistic. It's a country in decline.
I think there are a lot of things that can be incubated if they took care to incubate them, because the schools are still top-notch.
Well, the best ones.
Right. But the thing is, when the society goes into identity politics, meaning you vote because you are whatever it is you are, problems happen, right? And then if people are selected not on the basis of merit, let's be apolitical about this. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you look at the legislature and whatnot in China, scientists, engineers, educators, whatever, and then you look at the legislatures in the U.S., lawyers, they fight. They fight each other. And we can use a little bit less of that, maybe.
Mm-hmm. So there's a greater sense of purpose and meritocracy in the Chinese system versus the U.S. system at the moment. Does that sum up your
Very much so.
Yes.
And actually, the system didn't change that much in the last 5,000 years. It's just interrupted every now and then.
I know that you could speak for at least a podcast or two
on the history of China. We won't go there.
We haven't got the space, I'm afraid. Another day, Jay.
Yeah.
So there's been discussion that I know that you're interested in around the notion of a real split between the West and what we're
the bifurcation.
And we're calling BRICS.
Yep.
Which brings me back to your BRICS at your front door in America.
Yeah.
So
and that is so happening, by the way.
And it's which bit?
The bifurcation.
Okay.
It's happening big time.
Are you going to predict that there will be a split from SWIFT, for example, for the Chinese and the...
Well, I think the EU, Britain, and the US, they all need to do reindustrialization. They need to. Whether they can or not, it's a separate issue.
Yeah.
They all need to do reindustrialization, remilitarization, rebuilding infrastructure, rebuilding education. But all those re's arguably can be better done by in cooperation with China, but they're not. They're gung-ho about doing it against China for some reason. They choose to go the more expensive way, the less likely to succeed way, right? And China looks at this, and can China keep its $1 trillion in place in U.S. domain? Ask the Russians. Don't know. The bifurcation is going to happen because the trust is gone.
So if you were a betting man on this,
in fact,
you might.
I am.
You're rubbing your hands in glee. Yeah. So how will this, from a political point of view, how will this end up?
I think
between America and
the West people don't take I don't think people take China's timeline seriously. When the third plenum just ended, they said by 2035 we will, by 2049 we will, right?
And they will. Yeah.
Right? And if that's the case, China intends to be self-sufficient in a bunch of technologies. In fact, in all of the technologies. And the U.S. tries to block China everywhere. So just by that, whether it's Huawei communication or whatever, it will split. Mm. Right now, you've got two astronauts in the U.S. stuck up in the space station. The Russian things can dock, but the Chinese things cannot dock. It's a different standard. Mm. Right? So then I sort of say, okay, if that's the case, what is this thing that's called U.S. dollar? Mm. What is it actually good for? That Trump promised to devalue. Because to reindustrialize, to export again and all that, you need to devalue. You're competing against China. That's like asking the Australian gold miners to compete against the gold miners in South Africa. Good luck on that one. What is going to happen to the US dollar? Longer term, dollar down, gold up. But short term, because the US is essentially wrecking EU, NATO, capital moves, dollar up. So here we are. What do I do?
And traditionally, I know that you're very fond of gold as an investment. Yes?
I don't know if it's an investment, but certainly it's a saving of value. Right. It's savings. Different. Investment is buying a building in Hong Kong, which I don't suggest anybody does.
All right. So a moment ago, you hesitated about whether you should be...
You want to be long gold. Stands. You want to be long gold. Because here's the interesting thing. Had you bought 1 troy ounce of gold every year, starting 1982 when it was at its high, 800s, whatever, right? And every year on December 1st, boom, 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 buy. And you bought 1 unit of S&P 500, whatever the price, buy 1 unit. And you bought 1 barrel of oil, whatever the price, buy. Today, your gold would be, on average, 4.5x of cost. your S&P 500 would be about 9x, great return. Your barrels of oil would be about 2.5x, which arguably is the, let's say, inflation.
Yeah, the measure of inflation.
Right.
Yeah.
But then between 1982 and now, there were three episodes with a little bit of time lag, four episodes, with a little bit of time lag, where gold went up and stocks went down sharply to the extent of 50%. Now, if we run into one of those episodes again,
you'd be happy to have gold.
Gold would go from 4.5x to 9x, and S&P 500 will go from 9x to 4.5x. So gold is playing a role.
It's the hedge.
Yeah.
The traditional hedge.
Correct.
Can we just focus back on Hong Kong then? Because we've been global. We've looked at really China and America and their allies, be they economic or military. What about Hong Kong as a city? I mean, you and I have discussed in the past that, of course, it relies very heavily on property in the sense of, firstly, the government manages to contain taxation and make it such an attractive place for people to be from a tax point of view because it can sell land, and also that property has formed the backbone of a lot of people's individuals' wealth here. And yet you've just said, I don't recommend anyone buying property. That sounds like a negative signal on Hong Kong. Do you want to explain where you stand
okay.
on that?
I think we need to change the way we invested in Hong Kong. Previously, any Joe Schmo buying any luxury apartment and then just buy high, sell high, or buy low, sell high, right? And I think that may be over. But on the flip side, we have mutual friends who bought into the Wanzhou Hung and the old airport warehouses and things that's up for. And then when the Hong Kong government says we're going to rejuvenate, the plans are usually pretty good on delivery. So you just got to change the flavor of real estate, let's say.
Let's take a five-year span, Jay. Are we?
Okay, five-year span. The problem with Hong Kong people, regular Hong Kong people, is that if you tell them you can go 10x your money in 5 years, they don't want to hear about it.
They want to know what's happening by Christmas.
They want to know what's doubling this year.
Yeah.
Right? And we've seen it in Lan Guifeng and whatnot. I don't want to hear about 5 years from now.
No.
Well, I'm not as smart as those people. I do 5 years. Yeah, I'm just not that smart, you know. So yeah, industrial real estate is fine. Right now, in fact, the Hong Kong, the Wanzhou Hung real estate, they're down by about 50% for somebody who wants to sell.
Yes.
Right?
But there aren't many sellers.
Well, there are not many transactions.
No.
Right? My comment is go look for a transaction. I mean, my God, somebody must be going belly up. They always do.
Yes, yeah, someone. But we don't have a very large population of people with large mortgages.
No,
so
because
they can ride out a fall.
Yeah, thank God.
Yeah.
Thank God.
I know you spend a lot of time thinking about these issues.
I have to. Yes. I have to feed myself.
And I know that you have a very firm views on the way the world looks and how Hong Kong fits into it.
The other thing about Hong Kong is I am actually a believer in this Greater Bay story.
Yes.
If they can get that story half realized,
it'll work.
We will be flying.
Yeah.
And I don't see a little drop of water from China will flood this place. I don't see why the plan would fail. I don't see it.
So it may be a difficult patch we're in generally, not just Hong Kong, but the world.
The world. Yeah. And that's what opportunities are made of.
But if you don't lose sleep over the future of Hong Kong,
it remains
your home.
It remains my home, and also I figure with things the way they are, well, Arita probably at some point will have to return to Hong Kong, whether she wants to or not, right?
Yes.
Right. And then you look at the Taiwan situation. My comment is, well, at some psychological juncture, talking about the real estate side, I understand Taiwan has a long, long Pacific coastline with lovely homes. It's like everybody's worried about Taiwan. Yeah. I say, well, golly gee, what are they worried about?
Yes.
It's just China. Everybody speaks Chinese.
Yes. Well, look, we live in this interesting hot pot of a world at the moment.
Yep.
And thank you very much for coming in and talking to us.
Super.
Thank you for sharing your thoughts on investment and property and politics and for being brave in speaking up and yeah. and your fascinating childhood. My Yorkshire upbringing sounds awfully bland against all of yours. Jay, thanks so much for coming in to Harvey Law Matters. Thank you.